My next guest is a very interesting guy and a longtime friend, Mark Brumley, who is president and CEO of Ignatius Press. And I've known Mark going way back to the beginnings of the press when it was founded by Father Joseph Fessio in 1978. But Mark now runs the show. He oversees the magazines, the books. He oversees the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, editor of the Ignatius Press's Modern Apologetics Library. He publishes all kinds of articles himself and books. He's the author of How Not to Share Your Faith, very good title, I might say, co-author of A Study Guide to Jesus of Nazareth Holy Week, editor of A Study Guide to Jesus of Nazareth, and contributed to the five issues that matter most. I think I know what those are, but Mark lives with his wife, and her name is what, Mark?
Debbie.
Debbie. Mark lives with Debbie in Napa. They're lucky. They have five children, ranging from ages 17 to 30. Mark, great to have you on Church and Culture.
Well, Deal, it's always good to talk with you.
You know, I'm going back in my mind to that fateful year that I was a first-year professor at a Baptist college in Atlanta, and at the invitation of Erasmo Leva Maricakis, who was teaching at the Ignatius Institute, which was founded in 1976 at the University of San Francisco by Father Fessio again. And I found myself in the middle of the beginning of Ignatius Press. The first two books had just been published, one by Hans Urs von Balthasar, Heart of the World, translated by Erasmo, which I still think is a masterpiece of translation, absolute masterpiece. Yeah. And a book by Father Louis Bouillet on, I think it's called Woman in the Church. Is that correct, Mark?
Right. That's right.
And that was a great book, too, and it came out right in the face of the rise of feminism, especially in the Catholic Church and especially among nuns. And there I was sitting in the apartment of Ray Dennehy with you and Father Bouillet and Father Fessio. And, oh, what a very exciting time that was. Something very special was happening. I knew it. I wasn't even a Catholic yet. But as I look back on it, I was witness to the birth of a great Catholic institution that I rank. I wrote a book a few years ago about church and politics, Catholics and politics. I rank Ignatius Press, EWTN, and Legatus as the three seminal institutions, organizations that were founded during that time period that really changed the landscape of the Catholic Church in America. So you have the Ignatius Press, which you run, founded in 78, EWTN, founded in 81, and Legatus in 87. Is that how, I'm just curious, Mark, do you see yourself as the head of an organization, of a company, of a publisher, all kinds of, not just books, but videos and audio and so forth? You're kind of a game changer in the Catholic world. Do you see yourself that way?
Well, I think Ignatius Press certainly has had, you know, a very prominent role. I mean, I should say a significant role. How prominent it is, I don't know.
No, it's
but
prominent.
It's significant.
You can say prominent.
Well, maybe now because just the way things have changed in the church. But I think Ignatius Press had a central role in filling in a gap that had emerged in Catholic culture and life, and that
but
is
Mark.
Gap.
You're way understating this. Come on, I'm going to have to call you on it. I mean, people like myself who were on the way into the church were going to used bookstores in Outer Mongolia,
right,
trying to find good Catholic books when all the stuff that was being published by the existing Catholic publishers was, you know, so far to the left, it made, you know,
right,
made no sense. There was nobody, except maybe for Tan, right,
mm-hmm,
was publishing, right, Orthodox Catholic books. You guys, not only, you didn't fill a void, you like filled this huge empty salt mine out there in the middle of nowhere.
Well, I would say that there were some other publishers who were doing good things, but the level of intellectual substance was sometimes lacking.
Substance.
Our Sunday visit wasn't around.
Yeah.
our Sunday Visitor was around, and they were publishing some books that were, you know, pretty good, but they didn't, most of what they did was kind of popular.
But they weren't von Balthasar and Bouillet and de Lubac, all of whom were teachers of Father Fessio.
That's right. They did not have, our Sunday Visitor did not have that kind of theological heft. I would say also Observant publications emerged around that time, but they were serving mainly the charismatic movement. Again, I'm not trying to slight these other publishers.
But it wasn't their market. You went after serious theological works that were not available in translation. You also started commissioning serious works from British. I remember the great book by Christopher Derrick on C.S. Lewis, which I think people need to know that book. You know, why C.S. Lewis didn't go to Rome or something like that.
And it was called C.S. Lewis in the Church of Rome.
Right, wonderful. Is that still in print?
It is not. No,
it needs to be.
Most of our early books are still in print.
Yeah,
but that particular title.
I have a feeling one day that'll come back. But you started commissioning great works from British, American writers, you know, Scott Hahn, others. And then you really struck gold. Tell me if I'm wrong. In 1985, you've been in existence 7 years, and I know from being in touch with Erasmo and Father Fessio during that time and you that there was some struggling. I mean, face it, you had to raise money, keep this thing going. But you struck gold in 1985 with the Ratzinger Report. Tell us that story.
Well, of course, this was a famous book that had been interview book with Joseph Ratzinger, who at that time is the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And the gist of the book is sort of a, you know, we have in politics a State of the Union address by the President of the United States. Well, in this book, we had sort of a State of the Church, not given by the Pope, but by given by some review that was given to an Italian journalist, Vittorio Messori, and we did the English language version. So it was made
Which was quite a
available.
Coup for you. Quite a
it,
coup.
It was a huge coup, and obviously Father Fessio's relationship with Joseph Ratzinger had a lot to do with that. And then, you know, because of the nature of the book and
it ruffled feathers. It ruffled
Oh, it ruffled feathers. It just internationally it was a
right.
book that generated a lot of discussion. And so naturally enough, Ignatius Press having the American or the English language version, the US version, lots of people bought the book. Lots of people were very interested in hearing what then Cardinal Ratzinger had to say.
And let's put it in context. We all know that when Pope John Paul II was elected in November of 1978, that a lot of Catholics, especially in this country, were disturbed by the fact that he appeared to be Orthodox. Now, that word gets thrown around a lot, but basically, here is this vibrantly charismatic man, intelligent, charming, but he was Orthodox. That really scared a lot of people. That meant people were going to believe him. People were going to follow him, and they did. And so you've already got this instability. And by the way, I took over Crisis Magazine in 85. So I sort of came on the scene in terms of Catholic journalism the same, no, in 95, I'm sorry, 95. 10 years later, never mind.
Losing track. That's happening to all of us, isn't it?
Well, I know. But at least I know my kids' ages. And so in 85, though, the American church is still very much left-leaning. And so the Ratzinger Report comes out. And remember that all the disquietude created by Pope John Paul II putting down liberation theology, I mean, that really disturbed a lot of people and so forth. And here Ignatius Press is emerging, new kid on the block among Catholic publishers, you know, gets this best-selling blockbuster, which obviously created a lot of financial stability that you needed. But even more, it gave you visibility.
Absolutely. And I think part of it was the fact that it was this interesting confluence of substantial theological thinking about what's going on in the church today, and yet a sort of popular interest. So those two things came together.
Very readable. Book.
We'd obviously done you know, kind of high-end works. You mentioned de Lubac and of course, Ratzinger, some of his works, and Henri de Lubac, and all these, and Hans-Urs von Balthasar.
Romano Guardini, yes.
These are high-end theological works. It doesn't necessarily mean they're not accessible. It just means that people aren't going to automatically kind of gravitate towards them. But at the same time, this book had mass market appeal. It's just a
how many copies have you sold of that book? Do you know?
Oh boy, I'm sure over 300,000 copies or something like that.
Wow.
In the history of the
Is it still selling? Is it still a popular title?
It's still in print. I don't know how many copies it sells, but you know, it's still a very useful analysis. You mentioned the theological kind of bent of the church in the United States for the most part in the mid 80s. Well, you know, what this book does is it addresses some of the major themes that really needed to be addressed in order for the church to kind of get its act together. And, you know, among those is, how do we understand the Second Vatican Council? This is a theme that, you know, later Pope Benedict is going to develop when he talks to the Roman Curia, and that first, you know, curial address, a Christmas curial address in 2005, where he talks about a spirit of hermeneutic of reform as opposed to a hermeneutic of rupture, where we see the
by hermeneutic, fundamentally, you mean, hermeneutic means how you interpret things.
Right, ways you interpret. Yeah. So do you see the Second Vatican Council mainly as a rupture or a break from the past, or do you see it as something, there's reform, so there's change, but at the same time, there's fundamentally the church doesn't change. Her identity remains the same. And, of course, Ratzinger's view is that we should understand the council, Second Vatican Council, as we understand all the other councils, as not this radical break in the history of the church, but as part of an overall pattern of reform that happens from time to time.
Which, by the way, if you go read those, like I did as a convert, go read those documents without any prejudice, that's the way they feel. If you know, I went from the patristics to Aquinas and Newman and so forth, and when I read those documents, I thought, why does everybody think these are so liberal? You know, they really aren't.
Right, they're not. They're not. But what happened, as you know, after the Second Vatican Council, you know, there really were two councils, as Ratzinger has observed and others have observed. There's the council that actually met from 1962 to 1965 and produced some pastoral decisions and doctrinal statements and all of that, which we call
all under the umbrella of being pastoral.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But then there is the council of the popular media and of
Xavier Wren in the New York Magazine. That's his pseudonym.
That's right. And that interpretation of the council was what many people, including many priests and future bishops, imbibed.
I would say most. I would not say many. I would say most. Don't you agree?
Probably.
Yeah.
But then, so what happens is, in the late 60s and into the 70s, we get people in leadership positions of the church not so much implementing the council as implementing what they've read in the popular press or certain theologians' interpretation of the council, or what some theologians had hoped the council would say, but which the council, in fact, didn't say. So all of that goes on. And so in that sense, the Ratzinger Report and what we see in the pontificate of John Paul II is kind of a corrective. It's a corrective to a misunderstanding or a misreading of the council, not as it sometimes has been thought, that these men were trying to go back before the council or do away with the council, but they were trying to make sure that the council itself had its voice, that it actually got heard.
I would say that the Ratzinger Report that you published at Ignatius Press in 1985, and remember now that Vatican II was over in 64, I would say that was publicly the first serious challenge to the accepted view of Vatican II in the United States. Do you agree with that?
I think that's true. I think that's true. I mean, as far as books go and books that had a wide readership, you had before that, you had Monsignor Kelly's book, Battle for the American Church.
Great book, but, you know, it's only read by fans of Monsignor Kelly.
That's right.
But it told the true story. It told the true story.
Yeah, it really was about the American church.
Right,
And the Ratzinger Report was about the church universal. And, of course, obviously, in the local church in the diocese, it was pertinent to that because the universal church is made up of those churches. But you're right. I think this was the first major book to challenge the widely held narrative about the council.
And when you think now, that's, 20 years? It takes 20 years. That's a long time. That's a long time for a narrative
now
to be challenged.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it also put Ignatius Press on the map. Is that too strong a statement?
I think it did in many ways. Sure. Absolutely.
And did all of you that were inside of the press working so hard, you must have, you know, opened a bottle of champagne or something. You must have celebrated.
Well,
did
I don't
you?
Know about that, but... I don't know about that, but
I mean, you're allowed. You're Catholic.
General,
you're allowed to do that.
Yeah, that's right. In general, at Ignatius Press, I mean, we take delight in doing things that serve the mission of the church, and certainly that was the case with the Ratzinger Report. It's been the case with a number of other things that we've done over the years that have had a significant impact.
Now, are we talking about the Catechism or the Bible? What are you referring to that you've published?
Well, I'd say the Catechism of the Catholic Church. A lot of people don't know the story behind it.
Tell us. I know a little of it, but let me remind everybody who we're talking to. I'm talking to the president and CEO of Ignatius Press, the founder being Father Joseph Vesio. We're talking about the history of the Ignatius Press and the very important role that it has played in the post-Vatican II church in the United States. Now, tell us the story of how Ignatius Press got the rights to publish the official Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Well, the Ignatius Press contribution isn't so much in publishing it, because when the first edition of the Catechism came out, there were several American publishers. So it was a kind of a co-publishing thing that was done in connection with the United States Conference of Catholics, now what's called the USCCB. Then I think it was the U.S. Catholic Conference and the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. They were separate entities at that time. But the real issue, many of your listeners will know, that the Catechism came out, the original edition was in French, 1992. And there was the whole controversy of the Englishing of the Catechism. And here, you know, Father Fessio, and as in almost all of these Ignatius Press stories, you know, he sort of sees the problem, takes the lead to get the problem resolved, and contributes in his own way to, you know, helping the church in a significant way.
There was a problem of the translation.
What?
It was a problem.
The problem of the translation.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes this is kind of popularly described as, you know, the struggle over inclusive language in the Catechism, and that was certainly a component to the translation that was being floated out there. But there were just all kinds of things. I mean, leaving out whole sections of Catechism that had been kind of...
Are you serious?
Lack of
I
a
didn't know
term,
that. Were there whole sections
down,
left out?
You know?
Really?
Just material that was maybe a paragraph length being reduced significantly, and key ideas in that paragraph being left out because they were regarded as things that didn't fit with a proper enculturation of
the American view.
The American view. So, we'd have to go back and look at some
now. You guys caught this. I mean, you all caught this very quickly, I think, right?
Yes, absolutely. And there was also the struggle over inclusive language, where there was an ideological use of language. You know, where references to man were systematically changed, you know, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And
let me remind our listeners that we're talking about 1994. We have a text for the Catechism approved by John Paul II in 92. We have a French edition in the same year. But the first English translation came out in 94, correct?
Right.
And then you're really talking about what happened from there. You started seeing translations that were mangled, but also just missing entire sections, correct?
Yeah, material that's being unduly reduced for logical or reasons. You know, it's being presented as we need to adapt this to the American situation, when in fact it's a kind of adaptation that really is kind of selling out the faith of the church to the culture,
mm-hmm.
or to an ideology or things of that sort. So that's what's going on at this time, and Father Fessio and a number of other people, but Father Fessio, who, you know, he's in charge of Ignatius Press. Ignatius Press is going to be one of the publishers of this.
Now, where are you in the pecking order at this point at Ignatius Press?
I'm not here. I'm not here at this point.
Now, when did you get there? Let's establish that. When did you arrive?
I came in 95, although I knew Father Fessio and was doing various things.
I remember. You were definitely part of the scene. And so keep going. So Father Fessio and others catch this, and then what happens?
And there's a whole controversy. There's the version of the catechism that's sort of the official English translation that's not been made official yet. It's circulating out there. And so Father Fessio and a team of other people, including a number of friends of mine, decide that, well, they want to show what a real English translation of the catechism looks like. So they scramble to put together this translation, and it winds up getting sent to Rome. And
now, is this a translation from the French or from the Latin?
Right now, at that point, only the French exists.
Right.
Only the French text. The catechism mm-hmm. originally is written in French. They don't have
right.
the official
Latin. Because it was Father Cotier was the primary editor of that.
Right. So so we have this, and what winds up happening is you have these two versions in circulation. Okay? There's no official final English translation yet, and the differences are palpable. You don't have to be a great theologian to see that the second edition, this edition that Father Fessio spearheads getting translated, is just simply superior. It's more faithful. It's more accurate. It's not ideologized in its use of, you know, it uses traditional inclusive language instead of feminist ideologized mm-hmm. inclusive language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's just better on all counts. Well, what are you going to do then? Because the English-speaking bishops have been circulating and working to get this particular version done. So what winds up happening as a result of this intervention, a third draft, a third English translation is created. But in fact, that English translation that goes on to become the official translation of the Catechism really is the translation that Father Fessio and his team put together. In fact, it is. I mean, it's modified slightly here and there, but in essence, it is that translation. So that goes on to become the translation of the Catechism of the Catholic
Church. And it's
Church.
Now the one that the bishops themselves promulgate.
Absolutely.
So what happened to the bogus ones? They just drop out, disappear?
The bogus translation. Once an official translation is accepted for English, for all English-speaking countries, then the other draft, the original proposed draft of the mm-hmm. translation, It just disappears.
There must have been a lot of angry hornets in the hive at that point.
Well, there were. And you have to remember, and you probably do remember this deal, the whole idea of having what was called a universal catechism, a catechism that really is a modern expression of the faith that is a starting point for all other catechisms worldwide. That whole idea of a universal catechism was attacked by a number of theologians and a few bishops, mostly theologians, in the church, because they said that we can't have such a universal catechism in the church today. There's no way to express the faith of the church in some kind of fundamental way that then other catechisms can take and adapt and apply to particular cultures.
Yeah, they had all so taken already, the postmodern turn, but they were all postmodernists by then.
They were.
Yeah.
So out of the gate, the very idea of a catechism was...
Right. Anything universal, catechism. Anything authoritative.
That's right.
And I am... I want you to... I'm looking at the time. I don't want to let you, you know, come up with another gem and have to cut you off in the middle. I'm talking with Mark Brumley, who is president and CEO of Ignatius Press, about the history of that press, some of the most important moments, controversial, but also very important and significant in the Catholic Church in America. And we'll be back with Mark in just a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back. We're talking with the president and CEO of Ignatius Press, which, of course, covers a lot of territory, including videos, audios. It covers a Bible series. It publishes the Catechism. It publishes the Ignatius Bible. It is easily the most important Catholic publisher in the United States, if not worldwide, and it was the first Catholic publisher to break into the mainstream market of Borders, Barnes and Noble. It was the first time you started seeing these books on the shelves. Mark, how did that happen? I must say, as you know, I'm a book shopper. I'm addicted. You know, I go to Book Buyers Anonymous, you know, a couple times a week.
We don't like Book Buyers Anonymous.
I remember the first time I was in a bookstore, I think it was in New York, Barnes & Noble, and lo and behold, there were a whole bunch of Ignatius Press books. And I thought to myself, wow, what a milestone. How did that happen?
Well, you know, Tony Ryan, our marketing director, has been with Ignatius Press for quite a number of years. I mean, mm-hmm. I think he's been with Ignatius for 30 years, and he just basically invented... distribution of Catholic books in the secular chains. He's works with a sales team that we collaborate with called Midpoint. And Tony doesn't believe that there's any reason why major secular points of distribution should not be selling Ignatius Press titles.
So that's he doesn't take prisoners. He just goes.
He does not.
Yes.
And that's why you also see our books widely advertised. We probably, there are other Catholic publishers who advertise, but we probably are the Catholic publisher you're most apt to see publish in, you know, significant Catholic journals, and even sometimes secular journals or non-Catholic Christian publications. And then, again, that's Tony Ryan's philosophy that...
Well, it's also Father Fessio's, too. It seems to me that the attitude from the beginning was, we're not going to be a mom-and-pop company. We're not going to be a small niche company. We are going to become a major book publisher and a force in the church and the culture. Is that right?
Well, I'd say the attitude was actually, we're going to publish books that we like and we think are important, and we're going to do our best to get, you know, make people aware of those books. I don't think anybody, in fact, I would suspect that Father Fessio wouldn't set out to say, we're going to become the biggest and the best. Just, it's not in his nature. He's got a competitive spirit to him.
Well, I remember running through the park up there in San Francisco with him, trying to keep up with him.
That's right. But, I mean, I think that these things are really kind of viewed as means to the end. The end is to make to get books out that we think are important, helpful to the church, helpful to people, and get them out in front of people. And of course, to do that, you have to advertise, you have to market, you have to promote. So, and you want to be as good at advertising and marketing and promotion as you can be. That's part of that, you know, sort of legitimate.
The business model. It's a basic business model. I'm talking with Mark Brumley, president and CEO of Ignatius Press, about its remarkable growth since 1978. What What books have really surprised you in terms of their sales over the years? What sort of popped up as a really strong seller that you didn't expect?
Well, I'll tell you a book that I thought would do well, but I didn't have any idea how well it would do is probably our best-selling book of all time, which is the UCAT, the Youth Catechism, that we published back in, I think, 2010, something like that,
mm-hmm.
Which is a youth-oriented adaptation of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I think we've sold well over 500,000 copies of that book in the last 3 or 4 years. And, of course, I thought it would do well. I remember when Pope Benedict went to World Youth Day and the compendium of the Catholic Church was distributed to the young people there. The compendium is just this sort of condensation of the catechism. And it was distributed there at World Youth Day, and they had a special youth edition and all of that. And I remember getting a copy of the compendium and saying to myself, well, this is fine. It's pleasant enough, but I can't see, you know, all these young people getting excited about this. You know, somebody needs to take the catechism and adapt it, you know, for the young people so that the high school age kids can really get the substance of what's there. Well, apparently there was a lady, a German lady, who had the same reaction, and she kind of gave Cardinal Schönborn, who's one of the principal editors of the catechism, what for. Because she said, look at this great catechism, it's beautiful.
And they say there's no role for women in the Catholic Church, right?
That's right. But, you know, this is not something that, you know, high schoolers are going to be able to get. We want them to have the content of this, but we want it adapted for them. And from that, you know, Cardinal Schönborn got together a team of young people, and they produced UCAT, which is now available in, I don't know, some 20-odd different languages.
Did it originally come out in German, and you had to translate it into English?
It originally came out in German. We have the English language edition. In English alone, we've sold 600,000 copies.
Wow.
Just to give you an example.
What was the disappointing book? Not that I want to name names or embarrass anybody, but did you have any anything that you invested in that really disappointed you?
You know,
I mean, how did your Chesterton edition do?
Well, we've done the collected works of Chesterton. And I think I wouldn't say that we're disappointed with the sales. I would say that because we value Chesterton. I mean,
absolutely.
In a lot of ways,
I think it's
Fessio,
great that you did it.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, Father Fessio and Ignatius Press played a pivotal role in the resurgence of interest in Chesterton.
Right.
Publishing Chesterton's books by publishing the collected works and so on. So Chesterton is very important. I would say, yeah, that's probably a series that hasn't done as well as you would hope. But the individual volumes of the series, you know, I should say the individual books that have volumes in the series, Everlasting Man, Orthodoxy,
right.
The Man Who Was Thursday,
right.
The Catholic Church in Conversion.
They kind of make up
these different
for the losses on the other books, right?
Absolutely. And those individual titles sell extremely well. And they, you know, sort of kind of create or perpetuate this interest in Chesterton. So that would be an example of something I would have thought might have done better, but, you know, still has served its purpose.
Yes, absolutely. I'm talking with Mark Brumley, who runs Ignatius Press. How did you do with your investment in Catholic novels? How has that gone? When did that start? Did it get off to a quick start? Was it slow? How do you feel about publishing Catholic novels at this point?
Well, I love publishing Catholic novels. I think they're very important. Let me back up. There were some early novels that Ignatius Press did. Russell Shaw, of all people, and people know Russell Shaw.
We interviewed him last week on this show.
Right, as a commentator on things going on in the church. But he actually wrote a book which Ignatius Press published called Renewal, which was kind of a novel on the post-Vatican II era. And, you know, it did all right. And there were a few other little works of fiction that were published as novels, but as new novels. We for years had been published in Lewis DeWool's novels from back in the 40s and 50s.
Which are very useful to keep in print.
Absolutely, very useful. But they're not really contemporary novels, that type of thing. Well, along came a fellow named Michael O'Brien, who had a book about the end of the world, about the rise of the Antichrist.
Right.
And this was a book that he did in a serious way. It was the idea of this Antichrist figure arising and the church trying to find somebody who had sort of global political clout who could try to reach this man.
This is, by the way, Father Elijah, right?
I was going to build up to the title there, but yes, might reach this man who may or may not have been the Antichrist, and maybe he could bring him along and convert him, and therefore the end of the world wouldn't happen just then. Well, it turns out, you know, this figure is Father Elijah, who's a convert from Judaism and former, highly placed Israeli political figure. And this book did incredibly well. I mean, it's very well written, but it's at the same time, it's a page turner. It's not.
But it's also, kind of, it has theological depth, serious theological depth.
It moves along at a very good pace. It's a thriller. It's kind of a theological thriller.
Mm-hmm. It's really like Charles Williams in a way. It has a very Charles Williams.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. And it sort of launches the resurgence of Catholic novels, at least for Ignatius Press. And there's a whole series of books that Michael has written, the Children of the Last Days novels, where these are all kind of interrelated. Now he's moved beyond that. And so those were among the first novels in a serious way that when Ignatius Press decided, hey, we really want to kind of get into this and push it. And it's done well. Those books have done well. The other novels haven't done quite so well. And I think that's partly just because Catholics are reacquiring the taste for novels.
Well, you know, I'm doing all I can to help you on that score.
Yeah. I think a lot of Catholics have lost a taste for the novel, and they're used to reading. If they read novels, they read secular novels, and they don't quite know what to do with the Catholic novel. And I think we're at a point now where we're just beginning to see a significant resurgence of the Catholic novel. And so I think our novels are going to do better in that regard.
Well, you have a wonderful list, and I would recommend that our listeners go to ignatiuspress.com. I'm sorry, is that your URL, or what is your URL?
Ignatius.com. Go there.
Go to the section on novels and look at all the authors. You've got quite a few authors here, including Piers Paul Reid, who's a very distinguished writer. And you have some wonderful reprints. Siegfried Unset, my favorite. Jose Maria Gironella, Cyprus's Believe in God, one of the great Catholic novels. And you have some wonderful newer discoveries, Eugenio Corti, and also Fiorella de Maria. So you have just a wonderful breadth of offerings in your novels section.
Yeah, I encourage people they can go to Ignatius.com. They can also go to a novel website that we've created called IP, as in Ignatius Press, ipnovels.com, and you can not only find out about our novels, but you can read blog posts by some of our novelists.
Yes, ipnovel.com.
IP Novels, plural, ipnovels.com.
Now, I know that you deal with a lot of the transom submissions. And I'm sure there are people right now saying, ooh, it's neat. Deal's talking to the publisher, president of Ignatius Press. I always wanted to get a book to him.
Right. That's right.
And I know I open you up for this, but this is a chance for you to tell that person how to do it in a way that is professional. How should somebody actually submit, and what should they submit to you?
Well, ideally, you as a publisher, you like to get a well-written manuscript in hard copy form that uses your house style and is pretty much ready to be sent to the copy editor.
Mm-hmm.
But that rarely happens.
Do you want a full manuscript, or do you want a outline and a finished chapter?
You know, it never hurts. It never hurts to say, "Here's a proposal," or "Here's a proposal with a sample chapter. Are you interested in a book on this topic?"
Right.
If you know how this works, Neil. If you're an experienced author, you published author, obviously you have more standing with a publishing company than someone who's writing his first book. But even if you're only writing your first book, or if you are writing your first book, it's good to have, you know, introductory letter and here's what I'm interested in writing on. Here's a sample chapter.
In other words, don't send your 400-page book unless of course you've already written it.
You know,
send the idea and then send one substantial chapter that shows what you've got.
Right. If you've already written your 400-page book, feel free to send it.
Yeah, exactly.
If you haven't and you're trying to figure out, well, do I want to spend the time on this? Is there a publisher or is Ignatius Press a publisher that might be interested in it?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's nothing wrong with sending a proposal. You send a cover letter and you send a sample chapter or two and say, is it you think this would be something that you're interested in? Now, of course, ultimately, we're either going to accept or reject a manuscript. We're not going to just say, oh, yeah, well, we'll here's your $1 million advance based on this single chapter of a book. But that's a place to begin and a way to start if you're an inexperienced writer. If you're an experienced writer, of course, you've got your experience to draw on and your set of published works to refer to and so on.
You know, years ago when I was seeing Father Fessio more regularly than I have in a while, I urged him to go in the direction of movies and of music.
Mm-hmm.
How has Ignatius Press done in those areas?
Films and music have done pretty well. Films, especially music, we do okay. We publish a catalog that features music, and most of it is traditional or classical or something of that inspiration. We don't do a lot of contemporary music, or certainly don't do any contemporary Christian music.
Mostly sacred music, correct?
Sacred music. Not that there isn't a place for the other, but it's not really us.
How much have you done in the area of e-books and downloading? I know you've done it, but how much are you fully invested into that world as well?
Almost all of our books now come out in at least two formats. That is print and e-book format. There was a time when we were doing audiobooks at the same pace. We'd come out in three. We've cut back on audiobooks now and confine ourselves mostly to prominent titles, books that we're coming out with in the season that are going to be big sellers, because we find that the interest in audiobooks is not as great as it once was.
Are you selling your product through Audible?
You know, we do sell our product through our own online downloadable.
But you don't collaborate through Audible or any of the other audiobook.
We haven't, because we haven't found the terms that Audible offers to be all that good for us.
Well, they're like Amazon. They've kind of got a monopoly on it, right?
Yeah, sort of like that. So, but our e-books do extremely well. And in fact, our e-books are on Amazon, but they're also on our own website, Barnes & Noble as well. So all the prominent places where our print books are sold online, our e-books are available. So we try to do both.
Is Amazon hurting you, Ignatius Press, or is it helping you?
You know, I have to say that on the whole, it's helping us. I think it may be hurting the Catholic stores, but the publishers, I don't think, are really suffering so much from Amazon. I think and to some extent, Amazon allows us access to a segment of the market we'd otherwise not have. But on the other hand, I think Amazon does tend to hurt Catholic stores because lots of people go to Amazon first.
I mean, it hurts all books.
Rather than...
Don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, any
book you type...
Yeah, I mean, you go into Barnes & Noble. I mean, I used to love Borders. They closed that. And you realize that this $35 book you're looking at that you want, you can get it for, $26.99 from Amazon. And you get free shipping if you're a member, That's a lot of money. I mean, that's a significant difference.
Right, and I think Amazon has on these great discounts. I think Amazon is moderated. They're not quite as great as they once were, but nevertheless, I think it's true. I think that there's a little bit of good old free market competition at work there, and it has advantages to it. At the same time, I think the brick and mortar stores, especially the Catholic stores, provide a service that goes beyond just making books available. So that's why when we do our radio advertising, for example, for our books, or radio promotion for our books, we say, go to your local Catholic bookstore before we actually direct them to Ignatius.com. So we want them to go to the brick and mortar store first. If they can't get it at the brick and mortar store, or if they're not, if they don't have a brick and mortar Catholic store in their area, that's fine, and then they can go to Ignatius.com and purchase it there, or go to Amazon if they like and purchase it there. But we really do think that the brick-and-mortar stores really engage in a kind of ministry. It's not just about selling books, but helping to evangelize and catechize people.
I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't go to bookstores anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, horrors. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground. Before I get to my last question, which is going to be about Hans Urs von Balthasar, what's in the future for Ignatius Press? I mean, are there any things coming down the pike that we should know about?
Well, right now we are poised to release a book by Colin Ray, the country music singer, which is his autobiography, talking about his conversion to the Catholic faith and his life in the music industry. What he's seen there is good and what's bad. So that's going to be released soon. We have an outstanding book by Jennifer Fulweiler, who's a convert from atheism.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jennifer's very, very popular online presence. Mm-hmm. And her book is called Something Other Than God. The title comes from C.S. Lewis.
That's going to be a good one.
I think you've heard of this issue of homosexuality and same-sex marriage and related
and I noticed that you haven't stayed away from it either in your writing. So you've got Robert Riley's book coming out.
I was going to say we've got a book coming out by Robert Riley.
Yeah, lives a mile from me. One of my best friends here in Washington.
It's called Making Gay Okay, How Rationalizing Homosexual Behavior is Changing Everything. And we think this is going to be a pretty significant
book. I told Bobby better get the locks changed on his house when this comes out.
He better, yeah. He better.
This is really going to make a splash, big time.
We're right here in the city of St. Francis, San Francisco, right. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens to that book. So, these are titles that are coming out this season, but we have some other major things in the works, and it's always something. You're always trying to keep engaging the culture and evangelizing the church and everything. So
we've got
what
a few minutes left.
Future mission.
And my great affection for what you all have done started with Erasmo Levo Maricakis's translations of Hans Urs von Balthasar, who he introduced me to when we were together at graduate school in Emory before there was hardly any translation. Now, can you say offhand how many volumes of von Balthasar you've done so far? Are there any remaining? And which ones have been the most popular?
Well, that's a very good question. Boy, how many volumes do we have of different individual titles?
You can just ballpark that one. That's really kind of an unfair question.
I'd probably say 25, something like that.
Almost all in hardback. Not all, but mostly in hardback.
Yeah, I mean, we have some in hardback, some in soft cover. Depends on the book.
But your soft covers are the European style, which are much better.
Yeah, more durable, that kind of thing. And all of our books, are on acid-free paper, and they're sewn bindings, and we try to be high-end.
No, they're very nicely presented. I mean, you guys really present the books nicely. But which of the von Balthasars have been the most popular?
That would be hard to say. I think Heart of the World, which is the early book that you referred to, it's probably the one that's sold the most. But, of course, it's been the one that's been around the longest.
It's so powerful. I'm telling our listeners, got to read Heart. I mean, I can still quote an entire paragraph of that book from memory. I mean, it's one of the books
profound
that brought me into the church. So I didn't come to the church till 84, and I read that book in, I guess, in 80, right after Erasmo translated it. Of course, he dedicated to me his translation of von Balthasar's book on Mary, which is one of my great, you know, great moments that he would do that. And he said to Deal, who asked me about Mary. How have these multi-volume theological works done, you know, the theological aesthetics and the theological grammatic and so forth?
Well, how have they done? As you might expect, these are hefty volumes, and they tend to be more expensive as hefty volumes. I have to say, the impact of the works has been much greater than the sales of the works.
Yeah, and you knew that going into it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
And no one entertained a thought that, you know, the multiple volumes of theological aesthetics were going to be New York Times bestsellers.
Right.
They're not that kind of work. They're not aimed at that kind of popular audience.
But you remain committed to doing these kind of things.
Absolutely. And the people that read them are influenced by them, and they in turn influence others.
Right.
So that's really the story of those works.
And you've done that with, you know, Henri de Lubac, and other writers, which all of whom are long overdue for the kind of visibility you've given them.
Well, I was just reading The Way of Humility, which is a book we just published by Jorge Bergoglio, Pope Francis, in which, in a series of the meditations, he refers to de Lubac's book, Splendor of the Church. So, you know, we're happy that
You're in the Pope's mind. You can't beat that.
There you are.
Okay, on that note, I will say to Mark Brumley, President and CEO of Ignatius Press, thank you so much for being with us on Church and Culture.
As we close, I want to thank each of you for listening. I hope you found it as enjoyable as I have in bringing it to you. Join me again next week on Church and Culture, brought to you by Ave Maria Radio.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.